Well, joining us right now is a gentleman who has literally spent his entire life thinking about and shaping the character of young people. He is the head of school, Adam Rohde, at the Greenwich Country Day School, the only co-ed nursery to grade 12 college prep day school in Greenwich. He also teaches 8th grade U.S. history, so he's in the classroom with the kids every day. He coaches boys basketball. Prior to being at Country Day, he was the assistant headmaster and head of the upper school at the Pingree School in New Jersey, which is a well-known college prep school there, too. He has very definitely not only Connecticut roots in terms of the ones he's establishing now, but he's a graduate of Wesleyan University in Middletown. After that, he received his master's in Stanford in California, and he has been the head of various professional organizations. He has a wife, he has two children, and we welcome Adam Rohde to the show. Hello and good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So may I call you Adam? Please call me Lisa.
Please.
Okay.
Please.
So,
sure.
Thank you. By the way, what do they call you at school? What is the title that the children call you?
They just call me Mr. Rohde, and
Maybe
the basketball kids might go with Coach Rohde. So either one is fine with me.
So they don't say like head Rohde or something like that? There's
no
like designation like that? Okay. I didn't know. What do I know? I'm
not
a prep school person. Yeah. What can I tell you? I was public school. What can I tell you? Anyway.
Well, I was a public school person as well. So
yeah?
I find myself on the other side of the fence now.
Okay. Well, listen, there's a lot to recommend these lovely schools that you've been part of, but they are costly. And I think that they do a great job in making kids feel special. I wish the public school sometimes did that same aspect. But I was very intrigued by the fact that you wanted to have a conversation, in fact, did a couple of weeks ago, about shaping character for kids. And I'd like to hear first, Adam Rohde, what is the end goal that you want to have with the kids that come through, that pass through your way?
Sure. Well, you know, I'm a believer that in any of these schools, and I'm a big believer and a proponent of the public schools as well, that kids are going to emerge from the schools. Their teachers are just sort of the best, and they're going to emerge from these schools able to write a five-paragraph essay and balance a chemical equation and know the Pythagorean theorem. What I think is going to differentiate.
Maybe. I think you're pushing it. But
let's hope.
Okay.
I'm for the most part, I'm a believer, and what I'm really sort of focused on is, if we can assume that for just a second, then it's this next part, which is, how do you produce children with a finely tuned moral compass? How do you produce children who, when they get to college and beyond, are going to be good teammates and good classmates and kids who are going to not be a drag on the health systems of colleges because they're depressed or they're anxious? How are they going to be kids who are going to be involved in community service and leaders in a positive way? And as I look at what we're trying to do at Country Day, we're just trying to be really intentional about that and make it at the forefront of our thinking.
So what are some of the secrets to the secret sauce to do that? I agree with you. I think we have far too few people as adults, even as children now, being raised by adults who are caring and considerate of others, who know what it's like to sublimate their own selfishness for the sake of other people. And we don't function well as a society unless we have those basic values. So how do you do that?
You know, it's in a million little ways, and then obviously some big ways. But I like to, when I walk on a school campus, try to get a sense of what is it that the school values. And I think you can find that by what are they putting on the walls? What kind of awards are they giving? What do they celebrate at their graduations? And, you know, as we think about what we're trying to do here, it really is all about character. And we have an acronym that's called Tiger Pride. And we start talking to the children, they're 3 years old, and it becomes almost like a verb for them. They'll say, that's not showing Tiger Pride. And Tiger Pride is an acronym. It means like thoughtful and inclusive and generous and empathetic and respectful and polite and responsible. And I can go through the sort of the list. And if you're talking about that with children all the time, and it then becomes an age-appropriate way of really organizing their world, they know that it's important. And when I stand up in front of the kids on the first day of school in the high school and I tell them, you know, of all of our rules, we have a dress code and we have to be on time and the kinds of things which are sort of a drag for a high school kid. I tell them that at the end of the day, really the two that are going to have you on the couch in my office are tell the truth and be kind. And if you violate those two rules, the consequences are going to be swift and severe. At the end of our school year, we're going to celebrate the kids who are those kids who were not the most likely to succeed, but actually the most likely to help others succeed. And we use that verbiage when we give awards. We celebrate the artist and the academician as much as we might celebrate the athlete. And I think that's an important way of showing what is important in a school. And when kids know that being kind is important and being courteous is important and character is important, it is something that hopefully it becomes inculcated into them and they carry it with them for the rest of their lives. I'll give you one more quick example. You know, we'll give a little coin. It's a Tiger Pride coin. When a kid does something that's above and beyond, sticks up for a friend, tells somebody else that their language is inappropriate. And that might be just a one-off where we'll pull the kid aside and say, wow, that was really special. And this is just a little token of us saying we saw that and we caught you doing something good. And we want you to know how proud we are of you. And I'll call the parents that night and say, hey, I just wanted you to know that your daughter did something really amazing. She stuck up for a friend and we celebrate that. And so I think it's through those little things that you create that special sauce.
So I'm listening to you and I'd like to know, Adam Rohde, and I know that you're a professional in the independent day school world, but I'd like to know why it is we have decided as a society in many cases to abdicate that aspect of raising our kids in the public school world.
I'm not sure we've abdicated it as much as we've created a lot of bureaucracy, which has gotten in the way of because I'm, as I said, I'm a public school person. I grew up in public schools. I've taught in public schools. And I don't want to, think like our public school teachers have thrown their hands up. To the contrary, I think they fight against a system that becomes really difficult. When you have legislation coming from sort of the top around a set of core standards that you're going to be tested on in third grade and again in sixth grade, and you're going to be judged as a teacher by how well your children are doing on these tests, it really changes your focus. It really makes you say, okay, this is what's most important to me right now and to my success and my career. And then it almost forces some of these other aspects into the back seat. And I don't blame a teacher for that for a second. I think there's some structural, systematic things we have to look at.
It's interesting because honestly, it's all this. It's all part of, in other words, character. If you ask me, I think character is more important than specifically academics, but it doesn't mean that academics aren't important. And we do. We put a tremendous burden on our teachers. And maybe you're right. Maybe the issue is we're saddling the teachers into a system that, inevitably fails because it is too saddled with too much bureaucratic stuff. But we are failing in our public schools, Adam. We are. I mean, the statistics show we are.
Yeah, well, let me give you Greenwich Country Day for almost 100 years was a nursery through ninth grade school, which was a little bit of an interesting model. And then kids left us after eighth or ninth grade and went either to the public school, which is Greenwich High School, terrific public school, or went to the other independent schools in town or went off to boarding school. We, 4 years ago, added our senior school. So we're now a nursery through 12th grade school. But what was interesting was the day after we announced that we were going to open a high school, I actually got in the car and drove to Wesleyan University. You mentioned in the intro, that's where I went. I met with the president of the college and the provost of the college. And I said, if you were going to help me paint a picture of what a high school graduate you guys would like to see entering your hallways, talk to me about what that would look like. And they both said, and this was to a person, they said, we've just come back from a NESCAC meeting, and NESCAC are the New England small colleges. It's sort of the Bowden, Colby, Bates, Middlebury, Tufts, Trinity, Wesleyan, Williams, Amherst, that group, all very good schools. And the presidents had a two-hour meeting, and they really just discussed one thing, and it was this: the kind of kids that they have been receiving have created a 40% increased demand on their health services. The kids are coming in with depression, with anxiety, with suicidal ideation, with drug and alcohol, and that's becoming the overriding burden on these schools. And his point was, he didn't talk to me about academics for a second. He didn't say we need a median SAT score of X. He didn't say you should really spend time on the ACTs. He kept reminding me that this is all about character. It's about creating kids who are mature, who are well-rounded, who can advocate for themselves, who can engage in a discussion with an adult, who are going to be a friend to their classmate, who are going to be able to interact with a professor during office hours, those kind of things. And I believe, and you know, it's hard to fully believe, but I do believe that that is the direction that the college world is heading. And one indication that we are heading in that direction is the fact that there are 800 colleges that are now test optional. What's not changed in the public school world is this overriding focus on purely what I would call drill, kill, and bubble fill, which is, you know, we're going to drill and kill these skills because we're going to have to take a standardized test. And more and more research is showing us that that is not the 21st century way that our children are going to learn. And you and I haven't talked about this, but, you know, you throw COVID on top of all of this, and mm-hmm. it just adds this next level of all kinds of problems and downstream impact, which I don't think anybody fully understands quite yet.
So, you know, we're chatting with Adam Brody, the head of Greenwich Country Day School. It seems to me that, you know, the academic achievement was placed on our kids as a gloss on top of the assumed other attributes and skills of growing up. And I guess that those are not there now, right? So that's a problem. We have to sort of go back to foundational aspects of becoming a human being. I'm listening to you, and there are so many different ways I want to go with this conversation. But as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking, number one, how are we, if we're not taking standardized tests for academic achievement, how are the colleges thinking they're going to find out about whether or not they want this individual to be part of their college campus? Are they going to be going go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And just to take one step back, you know, you mentioned the teaching of, you said, the fundamental aspects of being a human being, and you're spot on that one. And I think what's happened, again, going back to the COVID, is imagine being out of school for a year when you were at one of these critical developmental stages of trying to figure out those fundamental aspects of being a human being, whether that's a kid who was in preschool, who was just coming into language acquisition, and your teacher was wearing a mask for a year and you couldn't see their lips move, or you were a middle school kid just trying to figure out what it means to be in a new friend group, and then you were forced home for a year. That's really forced the schools to pick up and kind of backfill some of those fundamental aspects of being a human being, because those kids lost that for a year. But jumping back to your question about sort of how are colleges going to kind of figure this out, that's in some ways the million-dollar question. I don't think, you know, USC, who gets 60,000 applications, is going to be able to move away from a standardized test model of how they're going to be able to evaluate their students. But I do think a school like Wesleyan, where they've become test optional, has already started to figure out ways to better get to know those kids. And that's going to be everything from their written essays, their teacher recommendations, the interview that they're going to have with the child, the ability to submit a portfolio. You know, you're an artist, you're a musician. They're excited to listen to your piano recital. They're excited to see some of your art in a digital format. And I think that the child's ability to tell their story and to show a real interest in the idea of learning is going to be a differentiator for kids. And then again, that goes to one of the ways where I think we fall down in education as a whole, which is education is kind of very top down for children, right? They're told that at 9 o'clock, you're going to put your algebra hat on, and at 9:45, you're going to put your English hat on, and you're going to move from one class to the other when the bell rings. There's very little agency for children. As we developed our new high school, we really tried to change that model. We want our juniors to have a real say in the what they study, the how they study. And people think that that's, like we're heretics. But what we're starting to find is it's really resonating with the colleges, and the children who are then sitting on the couch at the Princeton interview, I think are distinguishing themselves because they're able to share a story, which is very, very different than the probably 800 interviews that that person had had in the previous month. And that's because we're allowing way more agency in their own education. And that's true for a 15 and a 16 year old. And that's where some people might say you're a little bit crazy. But again, we're showing it to create deeper learning and stickier learning, which is, again, what everybody is sort of after at the end of the day.
We're chatting with Adam Rohde, the head of Greenwich Day School and the Greenwich Country Day School, pardon me. I'm really interested. I interviewed the gal, of course, I can't remember her name now, who wrote the book on the iGen generation, who did that enormous sociological study. I interviewed her as soon as the book came out. In fact, I was at WGCH in Greenwich at the time. And and she told me that the iPhone was transformative, like literally transformative, that she could see the difference in the ability to engage and all these different metrics that she was looking at in terms of development of youth from pre-iPhone generation, where there were always sort of skips and starts and issues to focus on, and post-iPhone generation. She called it the iGen. And I'm wondering, what is your school's attitude toward the iPhone, the cell phone, and what is your advice for parents?
Sure. Well, I'm not saying she's 100% spot on, and it's more and more research has come out just to back that up and to verify that. The first thing I'd say to parents is, and this is super hard, so I get it, but it's delay. As long as you can possibly delay, I think it's better for your kid. There's a national movement called Wait Till 8 around cell phone use. And what's interesting is I have a lot of parents in our school who really dig that idea in third grade and in fourth grade, and they rally around and they're excited to do it. And then when their kids get into fifth and sixth grade, they hand them phones. And I don't do that as an indictment of them. I do that. It's a reality. It's become the social currency at any school. And are you willing to have your child be outside the social structure because everybody else has it and you're going to say to your kid no? Now, I have parents that do that, and it's really interesting to watch, and I think those kids are able to be successful, but it's hard. And the battles that probably happen at the dinner table and at home are epic. And so I can see how it's easy for a parent. Yeah, epic. And I think that's why it's not hard for us to cave as parents. And so then once our children have a phone, the next delay. Then the next thing is we can't abdicate our role as parents and monitors on the iPhone platform, the social media stuff. You can say to your child, we're not going to put Snapchat on your phone. You can say to your child, the password is going to be something that I have, and every night I'm going to look through your phone. We can create all kinds of standards, and obviously they're going to change developmentally as your child gets older. But, we can say that your phone's not going to be in your room at night. You're going to charge your phone in the kitchen. And so at 8 o'clock, it gets plugged in the kitchen. You don't get it in your bedroom for the rest of the night. Those are hard, though. Able to do them.
No, those are not hard. Those are reasonable boundaries. I never let my kids have TVs in their bedroom. No. Those are not that hard. Mm-hmm. And an iPhone's a TV. So that's easy to me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the more we can regulate, the more we can observe and oversee, the better off we are. To talk about that iGen stuff, I would say that 70% of the discipline problems that we'll deal with at my school have some component of technology baked into them. And that's anything from, you know, an academic dishonesty piece where something was downloaded from the internet, not properly cited, to some mean-spirited behavior on social media. It is so much easier to be unkind in an anonymous world of disappearing tweets and Snapchats and things like that. And so we're again, very intentional about it at school. And so, you know, our middle school kids may not have a cell phone. They obviously have them. They have to be in their lockers from the second they walk in the building.
Excellent.
And then the only time they're ever allowed to use them is at 4 o'clock outside the building.
Excellent.
If they're texting their mom.
That to me
home.
Is it. See, that's something every public school should have. I don't understand why they don't do that. I don't get that. That would be a reason for me if I was today a parent to find the money or somehow enroll my kid in private school for that reason alone. For that reason, for that policy alone. Just to tune out and just have to be with other human beings.
There are a bunch of schools that have looked at different solutions to that. There are schools that collect the kids' phones as they walk in, and they have little pockets that they put them in, and they have to stay in those pockets during the day. And I can't speak to sort of – and I'm sure there are some public schools that have moved into that realm, and so I can't speak to why, you know, what other schools' policies are, but you know, we feel it's such a distraction and such a temptation that we've got to help our kids deal with it.
Adam Rohde, head of Greenwich Country Day School, thank you very much for coming on the show. I hope that you'll come back. I just think that there's so much to this conversation, and we need to keep having the conversation. So thank you.
Well, Pleasure being on, and glad you guys are having these kinds of conversations. I think they're helpful for all of us, and be happy to come back anytime.
Thank you so much. Joining us right now is Dr. Nonso Osakwe, an MD and the Director of Infectious Disease at Northern Westchester Hospital. Good morning, Dr. Osakwe, and thank you for joining us. Hi.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. So I guess the first question I want to ask you, because it's still relatively new, particularly to those of us who are older and don't have kids anymore that are little, what is RSV and why do we need to worry about it with our little ones?
Oh, thank you for that question. RSV means respiratory syncytial virus, and this is a common respiratory virus that can cause infections in the lungs and respiratory tract. It can cause cold-like symptoms, including runny nose, cough, sneezing, wheezing, fever. It can also cause low appetite.
But you know, that describes so many other things, right? Like they're all sort of the same symptoms. How would a pediatrician know if somebody has it?
Well, when you have your kids at home and your kids develop these symptoms, and they are common symptoms with every other cold, but you want to have your kids tested. You want to talk to your healthcare provider, because the only way you can actually know if your child actually has RSV, you know, you have the symptoms, but you also need to be tested to know if it's really that virus. Because like you said, many other viruses can have similar symptoms like this.
So there is a test in office for a pediatrician. If you spit into something, they can tell you right away if that's the virus?
Absolutely. They have tests that they can do. We have different kinds of tests, including PCR tests, you know, but once you talk to your pediatrician, you know, they will let you know what's available for you, but they have tests that can tell you if you have RSV.
Is there a treatment for RSV?
Well, unfortunately, most of the treatment they do now is kind of we treat the symptoms of RSV. And again, once you notice your child, you know, experiencing any of these symptoms, like cold-like symptoms, you need to talk to your pediatrician, you know, so that they can give you an advice on what to do if you notice the symptom is getting worse. Of course, you also have to go to the emergency department, you know, to have your child evaluated so that you can get the proper treatment that you need.
I guess what I'm asking you, doctor, we're chatting with Dr. Nonso Osakwe, is, you know, there are so many different quote-unquote common colds and viruses. So is it the high fever that would make you go to the next level? Is it a kind of asthmatic breathing situation? I mean, does every kid with a cold now have to be treated for RSV? Tell us, what's the protocol?
Absolutely, you observe your child. If your child has any of these symptoms, you know, most of these cold symptoms, a lot of kids, you know, do have it and, you know, may not need to go to the hospital for them. But if you notice your child is maybe having difficulties breathing and, you know, your fevers are persisting, getting, you know, worse, or your child is not eating, you know, they are not taking food the way they are supposed to eat, you know, they are, you know, maybe like younger kids passing urine, they're not having enough urine output, things like that. You know, once you notice your child is getting, you know, it's not doing better, you need to talk to your pediatrician. Or if you think your child is really getting sick, then you should go to the emergency department.
So what are we seeing, Dr. Nonso Asakwe, what are we seeing in the way of COVID this winter? Have we got it mostly under control? Are we seeing a lot fewer admissions to the hospital than we were? What are we seeing in the way of COVID?
Well, for COVID, of course, compared to the 2020 period, it's definitely lower than that. Right now, you know, from what I'm seeing in the hospital, I haven't really seen a lot of cases of COVID in the hospital now. You know, compared to what we saw in the past, is way down.
Good. That's good. And do you still, what is your, if I were to ask you, I'll just ask you, I got COVID in August after taking, you know, the two shots and a booster, but I got COVID. It's very common now. People get COVID. I got over it. I got it in August. What's your advice to me now for this winter? How long would you want me to wait between having had COVID and possibly getting a booster? Do I definitely need one? And if so, how much of a duration between having the disease and getting a booster would you say is optimal?
Well, if you've had COVID recently, you just got COVID recently, I wouldn't expect you to, you should have to give some time, you know, before you get the booster. Usually there are different guides, like the time that you can give, that you can take the vaccine that the CDC has, you know, kind of given us some time. You know, at some point it was like you had to stay for like 3 months, you know, before you can get another shot of the vaccine. You know, but if you just got COVID recently, I would wait. I would speak to my primary care doctor, or, you know, whichever doctor I see. If it's an infectious disease doctor you see, you know, then they'll let you know when you're due or when you will be able to get such booster.
So you don't have a hard and fast rule, you know, X amount of months from getting over COVID, that's when you would get the booster?
Well, in the past, we've been, you know, we said something like 3 months, you know, like 90 days or something like that.
I see.
I would speak to my primary care doctor just to see if you're eligible, because, again, it's not just, you know, just the time you got the COVID. They have to see if there's any other thing that may make you not be eligible to get this vaccine, you know. But, you know, it's a good idea to check with your primary care doctor, or if they are not able to, an infectious disease specialist, to give you a recommendation for that.
203-333-9422. Dr. Asakwe, what made you decide to go into this subspecialty? Why did you want to be in infectious diseases?
Absolutely. So, you know, it's a thing you kind of grow into. You know, like you go into medicine because it's just like a passion, you know, and you're happy with what you do. You do it, you're happy when you do what you do. And that's kind of the main drive here. Once you're happy with what you do, that's all that matters.
And you know? But why this specialty? What was attractive to you about this specialty?
Oh, so I had the opportunity of doing, you know, during your residency training, during your residency training, you get to be exposed to so many things, and you get to see what kind of specialty you would feel more comfortable. You get to see something that you really like to do. And while doing my residency, this is something that really struck out differently than the other ones. And so that's why I, you know, went forward with this.
I always thought of infectious diseases as the area of practice that you had to be a bit of a detective. you know, by its name alone, right? Sometimes people come to you, they really don't know what they have. They have no idea. They don't know if they have a parasite or a this or a that. They don't know what's going on, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But, yes. Yeah. You really have to have that patience to be able to, you know, look well to, you know, figure out what you're trying to find.
I understand that you received your medical degree in Nigeria, at the University of Nigeria, and then you came here in Montefiore and did a lot of training here. So where did you grow up in Nigeria? In Lagos? Where did you grow up?
No, Nigeria is it's a very big country, and, you know, we have, you know, very nice people, and there are so many tribes, ethnic groups, you know. So there's a town called Onitsha in Anambra State. This is where I'm from.
Very nice.
You know, you have very nice people from here, and, you know, multicultural, very nice culture, you know.
Are you the first person in your family to emigrate here?
No.
No? Yeah. It's very nice. I mean, I'm always interested in people's stories. My son-in-law emigrated here, too, and I'm always interested in how people came to this country and why they came here and are they happy here and all of that. Are you happy with your choice to have come here, Dr. Osakwe? Are you happy in America?
Absolutely.
Yeah? You like it here? Yeah. So in the meantime, I have another question for you. There is a vaccine I know against pneumonia, and I'm wondering, what is the recommendation for people to take a vaccine against pneumonia? And does it protect against all kinds of pneumonia?
Well, not exactly all kinds of pneumonia. There are, you know, there are different vaccines for pneumonia. Again, especially for adults, right? And most times, it's recommended for people who have predisposing medical conditions. You know, like chronic heart disease, chronic lung disease, liver disease. You know, people who have conditions that cause, you know, them to be immunocompromised, you know. They can either receive their different kinds of vaccines, PCV20, PCV15, followed by PPSV23, you know. But you just have to speak to your primary care doctor and see which one that you qualify for.
And as far as the flu vaccine this year, what do we think about getting the flu vaccine, and how protective is it?
Well, the flu vaccine, from what we are seeing from the CDC, you know, when according to the CDC studies, it reduces the risk of flu illness by about 40% to 60% among the overall population when most circulating flu viruses are well matched to those used to make flu vaccines. So we expect about 40% to 60%, you know, overall in the overall population, decrease in risk.
And is there only one flu that's circulating around this year, or do we have more than one flu at a time?
Well, these are infectious viruses, so there's a possibility to have more than one.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Nonso Osakwe, for joining us today as the Director of Infectious Disease at Northern Westchester Hospital. Thanks for sharing your information and expertise with us. We appreciate it.